If you're new here, my name's Joel. Every week we have teaching from the Bible, and we've been going through the book of Samuel. It's really the story of one of the great figures of the Bible, King David. We're looking at the latter part of his reign, which is filled with sadnesses and sorrows and errors of judgment as well. But we want to look at it carefully so that we can get all that we can out of his story. God is kind to us. He tells us the truth in this book about some of his favorite people, you could say, some of the people that he might have hidden the truth about for the sake of their reputation. He instead allows us to see some of the sides of their life that are very instructive by virtue of giving us examples of what not to do and how not to function, which paths not to take. And so it's helpful for us to look at this story thinking, how is it that David went the route he did and how can we learn from his error here? But a little bit of background, first of all, just to keep us roughly up to date. This is coming in on the story after David's very popular and good-looking and kind of charismatic son, Absalom, has grievously and maliciously murdered his brother Amnon. He was getting revenge on something that Amnon had done to his sister. Amnon and Absalom are kind of half-brothers. And Absalom, as an act of revenge, had plotted Amnon's death, murdered him, and had really, to kind of cover his traces, had hidden. He kept away from the capital, from Jerusalem, from the palace, from his father David, as a way of self-preservation. And David rightly has not invited Absalom back into Jerusalem. Wrongly, he has not passed sentence either. And it's at this point that the plot begins to twist further. So look at chapter 14, verse 1, and read onwards till verse 25. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa, brought from there a wise woman, and said to her, "Pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him." So Joab put the words in her mouth. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, "Save me, O king." And the king said to her, "What's your trouble?" And she answered, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. And there was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant, and they say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed.' And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house and I will give orders concerning you." And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, "On me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house, let the king and his throne be guiltless." The king said, "If anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again." Then she said, "Please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed." And he said, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Please let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." He said, "Speak." And the woman said, "Why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life. And he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now, I have come to say this to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid, and your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant, for the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together with the heritage of the Lord. And your servant thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you. Then the king answered the woman, do not hide from me anything I ask you. And the woman said, let my lord the king speak. And the king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? The woman answered and said, as surely as you live, my lord the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my Lord has wisdom, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all things that are on the earth. And the king said to Joab, behold now, I grant this. Go, bring back the young man Absalom. And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted the request of his servant. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. One of the things that we hear vague and subtle things about in current affairs is the way that dubious and clever background decisions can get made about the future of nations and the future of politicians and power mongers. We know a little bit about this, and probably we don't know anywhere near as much as we could know, because so much of it is done so secretively. But some of the great leaders, even of terrorist organizations and dictators and people who lead in totalitarian regimes, people who are seen as villains, certainly from our side of the world, have actually been people who, it seems at least, have been set in place by clever politicians, clever diplomats, clever people who thought, well, this guy is not squeaky clean, but he's probably the lesser of evils, so we'll support him, we'll fund him, we'll do away with his immediate enemies, and we'll see to it that he gets safe passage to power. And there are rumors that have gone around over the years over things like, you know, what role did the CIA have when it came to Osama bin Laden coming to have the position he had, and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and about who's really giving power away? Why is it that certain people are in positions they are? Is it because actually some meddling, usually from Western powers, has kind of secured them? Because it seems like, well, he's a bad guy, but he's not as bad as the badder guy who he's kind of against. And so let's put the bad guy in place. It's called realpolitik. It's kind of done by various clever diplomats. And I think Joab is basically doing that here. He's doing his bit of shady realpolitik. He's saying, Absalom, yeah, okay, he's a villain. He's not squeaky clean. He's not quite like David, but he's powerful. He's popular. He's plausible and persuasive. He's gifted. He's promising, and he's got potential, and maybe with some good advisors around him, he'd be the right guy. So we need to get him back in position because David is getting old. We can't assume that succession will be smooth. It's not obvious who else could be the succession to the throne. And this is an important throne, and this is an important nation. So I think Absalom needs to come back. Big problem with that. David doesn't really want Absalom back. David doesn't really trust Absalom. So how can we make this happen? Joab gets manipulative. And the way Joab gets manipulative is through a story. He tells a story. In fact, he doesn't tell it himself. He basically hires someone who is a brilliant storyteller. He gets the media in. He gets the spin doctors in. He goes and finds the wise woman of Tekoa. I guess she was particularly impressive and persuasive as a plausible storyteller. And so he brings her in to manipulate the king. He gets the spin doctor in. And it works. And I want to look at why it works. I want to see how this changes the king's mind and brings, sadly, a lot of disaster to follow. And the first thing to notice is very simply the power of stories. This is definitely an example of a story working on the heart of somebody, because already, as soon as David starts to hear it, he's joining sides. He wants to help this woman in her situation. Remember, perhaps if you have been with us a few months or weeks, you might remember another time something similar happened. Nathan, the prophet, came to David, tell him a story then, and David, he's kind of a sucker for stories, you might have noticed. He jumps in and says, oh, yeah, I want to help in this situation. He's stirred by examples of injustice. He's stirred by examples of need. He's a merciful man. He has a heart that gets easily played upon. And in that, he's not necessarily any different than you and me. We are creatures of story. That's part of being human. We can't really avoid it. It's harder to perhaps avoid a lot of things than it is to avoid being affected by powerful stories. They get to us. They get under our skin. It's actually the main way we learn. We really do learn through stories. That's why some of your teenage children, or some of you who might be teenagers here, will be told sometimes by school teachers to revise by telling yourselves sort of narrative stories to kind of help you remember things. Stories just have a way of getting in deeper, staying stickier. And they have a way of heightening our emotional involvement. We feel stirred, and it brings out a sense of injustice, which, by the way, is very hard to understand if there's no God. Just to kind of make this point quickly, it's pretty typical of our age, our time, that people kind of want to have their cake and eat it. They want to have the idea that there's righteousness, there's wrong, there's good, there's evil. There are definitely those things, because we are up in arms when we see injustice. As a society, we get angry. We want to find someone to blame when something awful happens, like Grenfell. There's a sense of that some injustice has happened. There's something wrong that needs to be dealt with. It needs to be confronted. And that sense of injustice within us suggests that we know more than we say we know. Because if we are convinced that there's some kind of ultimate law that we're all accountable to, there's some ultimate story of right and wrong where the right should be rewarded and the wrong should be punished and held to account, then that suggests that there's a lawgiver. In fact, it does more than suggest, it surely forces it. You can't have a law without a lawgiver. You can't have a story without a storyteller. And yet we kind of want to have it both ways. You want to have a godless universe, but we want to have the trappings of a God-filled universe, where there's right and wrong, there's justice and injustice. And certain people need to be punished, certain people need to be rewarded. Friends, if there's no God, then there's no such thing as justice. There's no such thing as right and wrong. There's no such thing as punishment and reward. There's no point. History has nothing going on whatsoever. If people go through a terrible disaster, as disastrous as even something like Grenfell Tower, in a godless universe, it actually doesn't mean anything. It actually doesn't mean anything that certain biological mistakes died in another mistake. Well, it's all a mistake anyway. Everything's an accident, so who cares? No, it's because we know better than that, really. We know deep down that certain things are wrong, certain things are terrible. And that there should be some kind of accountability. Sure, there should be looking into it, because it tells us something about ourselves. We deep down are hardwired to believe in a great story. We're moved by story. We're moved to passion sometimes. And I'd suggest to you, the reason we're like that is because of who made us and because of whose image we're made in. God himself, in the Bible, is a storyteller. When he came into the world as a man, do you know what he did? He came telling stories all the time. Jesus told stories. God in this book tells stories. In fact, he tells a great story of which you and I get to be part. Our whole lives are about story, and so we're bound to be inspired, motivated, and sometimes manipulated by stories, sometimes deluded by them. Sometimes stories speak louder than the plain facts that are before us. Sometimes an anecdote, an emotional appeal through a story will cause us to deliberately overlook information over here that is inconvenient to the story. This is how it so often works in our age. This is how a lot of social media works. We're moved by the anecdote, by the story, but we overlook the obvious information here that doesn't really fit the story. So we put it to one side. We're moved by a sense of purpose. And this is no small thing. Great world leaders have gone to war in recent years, very recent, even recent months, because of anecdotal ideas that there's not even necessarily all that much evidence for some of the reasons why people will go to war. So this happens on a big international scale. It happens in our lives. We might be angry because politicians take us to war because of, well, there wasn't that much information. It just fitted in with a big story that you're telling. But friends, we need to be careful. We do the same in our personal way all the time. We're moved and taken by a narrative, but we don't stop and reflect, think, is this true? Is it just passion? Passion achieves a lot in 21st century Brighton and beyond. It goes a long way. Passion wins a lot of debates. If you can say, I feel passionate about this, people will sometimes say, well, let's not even bother with the facts then. You feel passionate, or even, I am offended about this. Well, in that case, I'm grieved about this. This hurts me. I'm offended. Well, that will get you quite a long way sometimes. But we need to be wise that we don't allow that to be the only thing on the table. We need to also look carefully under the surface. And you need to do the same. Everyone needs to do this. Notice how subtle this woman is in this story. You may have seen it. It's fascinating. She tells a story that sounds like Absalom and Amnon a little bit. One son killed another, and now everyone's against the son, you know, the murderer, and really it's a shame because we should show mercy to the one who killed his brother. Shouldn't we be merciful? Shouldn't we be merciful, King David? She's using the story against David in this situation here. It's interesting that when she turns it on him and says, doesn't this make you think of your kids, David, King, mighty one, wonderful angel of God? He starts to see, I suppose it does. Then she turns it back to her own story. Notice how subtle she is. She's so clever. She's smart. She makes it seem like she really has come just to talk to him about her own personal family matters. That's the main thing. It's not the main thing at all. She's made it up. She's made it up. Look what she does. Verse 15, she says, now I have come to say this to my lord the king because the people have made me afraid and your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant. So she's saying, look, I really did come to talk to you about my kids, my boys. As far as we know, he's not even got any boys. She's so clever. She's making it seem as though the main thing she came to talk to him about was this thing over here. It's not. It's not. And people will do this. That's how it works. People will use something completely irrelevant to grab us emotionally when it's nothing. It's not the issue on the table. It's subtle. It's clever. It's lying. That's bald doesn't get very far usually. It's when it's subtle. It's when it's got a little bit of truth thrown in with it. It's when it looks like we're talking about something else. It's when people kind of pick our pockets by showing us another hand while the other hand is doing this in your pocket. That's when you're vulnerable. That's when we need to be watchful and make sure that we're conversant with truth. We're careful. We look at things carefully. Now, what I'm saying through all this is not stories are bad. I told you a minute ago, stories are wonderful. God made us to enjoy us. God put us in a story. God is the great storyteller. So I'm not saying, look, stories can be used manipulatively. So whatever you do, all become just sort of chemists and scientists with Bunsen burners and never go in for narratives. That's not what I'm saying. I'm actually saying there must be a true story. Find out what that is. Live by the right story. Live by the true story. And because God is gracious, he's given us his son, Jesus, who came into the world to give us the true story. He's the one that began so many of his sayings with those words, I tell you the truth. In a world that is lied to, that is manipulated, that is distracted, Jesus comes into our lives kindly, says, I tell you the truth. Jesus does. If we want to know who can we trust, well, I suggest to you Jesus. I offer you Jesus. I offer you the great true storyteller. I offer you his story, in fact, as a way of making sense of the world and making sense of yourself, making sense of your past, making sense of your future. Understand Jesus and what he has achieved and who he is. And the world begins to make a certain kind of sense. It starts to come together. And we sort of need, as Christians, if you follow Jesus already, and I know most of us here would say, yeah, I believe in Jesus. I'm trusting him. My faith is in his story. If that's true of you, my friend, you must get to know his story better. You must, because you're in a world which will constantly try to manipulate you away from it and sell you another story, sell you another cause, sell you another passion, and distract you from the truth. You mustn't be duped by counterfeit stories. And the only way to be safe from the counterfeit, how do they teach bank tellers to recognize false banknotes? They do it by spending a lot of time with real banknotes. You may have heard this illustration before. It's a good one. If you spend a lot of time with real, authentic banknotes, fivers, tenors, 20s, 50s, you spend a lot of time with them, you're not so easily manipulated. When a false one, you just know. You're just confident with the real ones. Spend a lot of time with God's story. Spend a lot of time reflecting. Take daily time. Discover more. Study it deeper. Get books that help you understand the Bible better. Get books that take you into the story, into the glorious picture that it presents to us. The more we do that, the wiser we'll be when there are alternative stories that creep into our worlds and into our minds. Make time for the true story. Now, there's so much more to say, so I'm going to just leave that point there, but hold it, all right? The power of stories needs to be redeemed in our lives, not allowed to take over our lives in a false way. But there's more to say, because David, think about it, David, I would have thought, is an example of someone who has spent time thinking about God's story. He's in it. He's written quite a lot of it, the Psalms. He knows God. He knows God well. And yet, this giant of wisdom, who's not conned easily, is conned here. He's manipulated here. So I think you've got to go further. What went wrong in David's heart to cause him to make this decision? And second thing, power of stories. Second thing, power of accusation. Power of accusation. Let's just quickly see this in verse 6. We'll just touch this briefly. This is in the speech that the lady brings to him. This is smart. She says to him, your servant had two sons and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them and one struck the other and killed him. Now notice in her story, this looks a little bit like manslaughter. It doesn't look quite, if you think about it, quite like, in fact, it doesn't look anything like what Amnon had done to him by Absalom. Now, if you've not been with us, you don't know this background. Maybe if you have been with us, you don't know this background, because it's all getting a bit confusing right now. But what's going on here is she's trying to compare this made-up story of her boys with David's story of his sons. Absalom, after 2 years of taking his time, thinking it through, planning it carefully, getting people involved, maliciously murdered his brother. She's telling a story of two boys that got into a quarrel while they were at work and kind of accidentally, one of them, you know, pushed the other guy in towards the machinery or, you know, they just kind of flared that moment of passion and he struck the other and, oh, he's dead. That's not what I meant. I didn't mean to kill him. That's kind of the tone, I think. And when you read earlier books in the Old Testament, you see that there are provisions made for these kinds of things. There is a difference in the Bible between murder and manslaughter. There's certain kinds of things that people can do in those situations. They can find a city of refuge and say, look, I didn't mean it. It's not a murder in that sense. And if it's a true case of manslaughter, it will get a slightly different, slightly more lenient sentence. But Absalom is not guilty of manslaughter. He's a murderer. No question. He's a murderer. So she is, like I said in the first point, she's twisting the story a bit here. But then notice, you skip down to verse 14, and she uses a little bit of tricky, semi-true theology here, where she says, but God will not take away life. That's what she's saying. She's saying, well, look, this is sad when boys do these things to each other, but God will not take away life. She's appealing to him for mercy towards Absalom because, well, God doesn't hurt people. God's compassionate, isn't he? Isn't he compassionate? Isn't God inclusive? Isn't God into diversity? Isn't God's wonderfully compassionate, David. That's the way she presents it to him. And David is thereby put into the corner of the bad guy because David has become, worst of all, less compassionate than God. Now, if you've ever been in the situation as a parent, as a school teacher, as a boss at work, as a leader in a church where you are being painted as less compassionate than God, you will make a decision that's wrong within seconds. Because you instinctively, I must be compassionate. This, she's saying that I'm not being compassionate towards my poor son Absalom. He's buying this accusation. She's accusing him. Saying, David, you're not being very much like God, are you? You're not very compassionate. So many people will make disastrous decisions because they feel accused of lack of compassion. And you definitely will, if you're not careful. You definitely will. You'll feel, oh gosh, I must do the compassionate thing, which in the situation, it may not be the compassionate thing. It may be foolish. It may in fact be wicked, but it looks compassionate. And there is a million miles between what looks compassionate and what is compassionate sometimes. In this case, for sure. By bringing Absalom back into Jerusalem, David is effectively inflicting civil war on his country. Out of compassion. Be wise, friends. If you get accused, oh, I'm not being, this will happen to you at work sometimes. Any Christian that this needs to stand up graciously, kindly, gently for a Christian view of the world, for a biblical view of things that are tough topics now, sanctity of life issues, gender issues, sexuality issues, you will definitely get accused of having no compassion in seconds. And whole institutions bow to that pressure, never mind individuals. And the heat is on at those times. Well, do I let this person in their situation define compassion for me? Or do I look carefully, think, am I lacking compassion? Am I going to, if I agree to this, am I going to be showing Christ-like compassion? Or am I going to be showing kind of a cowardice or a yielding to pressure? Friends, these are moments for us. They're around us all the time, aren't they? If you're a Christian, you know, I'm sure, more and more what I'm talking about. But you know this in your job, don't you? Some of you, your bosses, your managers. As I said, if you're parents, just to lead your children sometimes, you sometimes have to come across like you're lacking compassion when you know that you're not. You know that you're being compassionate. And you just need to hear God's definition and not allow dubious theology into your heart. God doesn't harm people. Have you read your Bible? God would never take a life. Well, actually, he takes everyone's life. You think God's like people, oh no, they're all dying. I didn't mean this. No, God's in control of history. God is in total control of all these things. He's not on the sides trying to desperately get a word in. Let God's word define compassion. Let Christ define compassion. By the way, it's a far richer, greater definition of compassion than any shabby, grey compassion that the world tries to give. So this is one of the other ways we can come under accusation. Third and final thing, he is manipulated not just by the power of stories, not by the power of accusation, but the power of convenience. The power of convenience, or I should say false convenience. Let's just back up and think about what's going on in this story. Now, hear me on this. This is massive, okay? David is king, yeah? And he's got to have a succession plan, I suppose, at this stage. He's late in life now. Some scholars say that all of what happens from sort of chapter 13 onwards happens in the last year of David's life. Now, I'm not sure if I agree, but that's an important point here. This is happening very late, for sure. Very late. And this issue of succession is big. If you know any British history, English history, you'll know that's sometimes been the case with the monarchy here. Who's going to take over from Elizabeth I? Who's going to take over from, there's no heir. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And like I say, Joab's trying to fix it. Now, David must be concerned about this if Joab is. David definitely feels this. And David, at this stage, surely has some idea of God's plan. When Solomon was born a few chapters earlier, God gave him a special name. God got involved. He said, don't call him that, call him this. God spoke about Solomon in a special way. There's a certain destiny, it would seem, over Solomon's life. But Solomon's perhaps a bit young at this stage. He's not very experienced. Absalom's impressive. People know Absalom. People like Absalom. And so David rashly reaches for the falsely convenient. It looks like Absalom must be king because the people say so, and it's, the alternative doesn't look very real at the moment. So I'm going to go with that. Now, this is huge because, why is it huge? It's huge because David actually, in his heart, he has been spoken to by God. You only have to go back a few pages. You get to chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, where God tells David that he, God, will see to it that David's throne is always occupied by one of his sons. God has promised a king from David's line, not just for the next generation, but forever and ever and ever. God has promised a future king, a Messiah, in fact. A Messiah, a savior, a rescuer, a greater king, a heroic king who will reign forever. That is God's problem, not David's. God's got to sort that out. But sometimes we're in situations as children of God where we don't know how God is going to sort a situation out. And so we assume he's not going to. We can't see how he's going to sort it out, so we think, we'll have to do it ourselves. And again, those temptations create rash decisions. It was like this in further back in the Bible. You get to Genesis, the story of Abraham. Very similar situation. God promised him a son. And it would be through his line, just like it's through David's line. One of the big things in the Bible is people caring about their future progeny, their children. Notice even, for example, the way the woman talks to David. Have you seen in verse 7? So they would destroy the heir also. Thus it would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. She's saying, don't deny me an heir. Don't take my son away. In other words, David, if you let Absalom get finished off somewhere out there in the desert instead of coming back into safety in the city, you will be deprived of an heir. You will not have a son. And the nation will not have a monarch. And the nation will go down the tubes because you didn't protect Absalom, the obvious king, who we all agree should be the king. She's scaring him. And he knows that he's called to raise up a generation of sons, great leaders for the future. He should have also known, or at least remembered, that God promised that he would do it. And when we try to do God's work with shady means, with bad solutions, with wicked solutions, in fact, we prove our foolishness. It's not wise, it's foolish. So Abraham, like I said, God's promised him a son. Abraham's old, his wife's old. They can't have kids, she's barren. It's impossible. It is impossible, God. You promised it would have a kid. It's impossible. I'll tell you what, God, I'll have a kid with my servant girl. That will be the answer. That will be the promise you made me, God. That will be you doing that. What? No, it won't. That will be called adultery. That will be sinful, having sex with your servant girl, who you're not married to. Yeah, is that the right? Is that the solution? Is that what God wanted? No. If God makes a promise to us, and he makes many in this book, and if God makes a promise to you in your life, there will be times where you're tempted to see it fulfilled through sometimes means that you just know aren't right. You know it's not right. You know it's not right. And you'll choose it anyway, because it's falsely convenient. But you're inviting disaster into your home. Some of you may have already done this. You may have made decisions, you know, I should never have done that. Now, the good news is God is able to redeem those situations in his amazing, true compassion. But friends, that doesn't happen just because God's nice and just, well, you know, I just let people off. That happens because God is absolutely righteous and loving at the same time. The only way that really, really we can have righteousness, the only way we can be really sure of walking close with God, having favor with God, is not through us manipulating him. It's not through us finding a convenient situation. See, many of us will try this in our relationship with God. You might be saying to yourself, well, I think I'd like to get to know God. Maybe that's why I've come to church today. Maybe you're here as a guest or as a friend of somebody and you're thinking, yeah, I think I need Christianity. I think I need Jesus. I think I believe in it, sort of. But I don't really want to take it too seriously. So I'll just carry on living the life I'm living and have sort of Jesus in my life as well. I'll invite Jesus in, but I won't let him change my life. I won't let him change my actual life. I'll just sort of go to church sometimes, and that will be my way of keeping God happy. You need to understand, friends, that that's called the wisdom of this world. That's what David gets fooled by here, the wisdom. This wise woman from Tekoa, this wise man, Joab, it's not real wisdom. Let's get Absalom on the throne. Let's not care about the fact he's a murderer and justice hasn't been done. Let's just bring him in because God will smile. God will bless it. God might bless it in his mercy, but he doesn't have to. And whatever we're doing, we're playing with fire, we're being foolish. We're not coming to God on his terms. If you want to come to God, you need to understand you come to the real God. If you invite Jesus into your life, he's going to take over your life. It's like inviting a bull into a china shop. He's going to change everything. He's going to do all kinds of stuff. He's going to change everything. But this is the thing. The person that's saying, I really want Jesus. Maybe this is you today. Maybe you're saying, I really want Jesus. That person, if you're saying that, you know, don't you, that that means humbling yourself. Saying, God, I've got nothing to be proud of before God. I can't boast in myself. I've done wrong. I can't trade with you. We're not partners. I can't, you know, scratch your back and you scratch mine. I've got nothing to bring except my weakness, failure, wrongdoing, wickedness. And I just ask you to forgive me. I just ask you to cleanse me. I just ask you to accept me as your servant, friend, maybe? If you come to God like that, what you'll find is that he has actually done for you the only thing that could be done. Because this great rescuer that David should have been waiting for, this great king, this great son of David, Jesus, the greater son, who came years and years later, Jesus, the perfect son of God, was crucified. Jesus was crucified. So that people who come to God, not saying, well, here's how impressive I am, look how well I've done, but people who come saying, here's how messed up I am, look how badly I've done. God doesn't just say, well, okay, well, we'll just forgive that, pretend it didn't happen, just let you back in, but don't make a fuss, just come back in, but we won't let you in the house. Remember David with Absalom? We'll let you in, but you're not allowed to see me. Is that how God accepts people? No, this is how God accepts people. He accepts you in his son, Jesus Christ, which means you are adopted. It means you are beloved. It means you sit at his table. It means God sings songs about you. It means God embraces you. He fills you with his spirit. He calls you his child. And he says, you are to never be guilty again. You are not condemned. The sentence is passed. Death has been dealt. Someone was crucified for your wrongdoing, so you can be truly forgiven. Not false compassion, utterly real compassion. So different than the world gives. God's wisdom in the cross is extraordinary. But it demands total humility from us. You can't come to God on your terms. You come on his terms, or you don't come at all. Say, God, forgive me, a sinner. Take over my life. We're going to come to the table in just a moment, and this is your opportunity to do just that. If you've decided today, I want to follow Jesus, how do you start? You start by coming to Jesus at the cross. You come to the cross where sin was dealt with, where sin was punished, where sins can be now forgiven. Even my sin? Yeah, even your sin. Let me just pray. Father, we thank you for this Savior, Jesus, and we ask you, Father, for the power of his grace to work through this room, even as we celebrate at your table. In your name, amen.